This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. That means we take time out to talk to reporters and local media about the stories they've put out in print and online. And we begin today with a conversation with Times of Northwest Indiana Chief Political Reporter Dan Carden. Dan, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Happy to be here.
Well, some great stories you've had put out there, some of them involving the action from the General Assembly session and some just here in Northwest Indiana. Let's begin first, please, with a bill that I guess you could say has been for a long time State Representative Hal Slager's pet peeve, and it deals with young people and making sure they get the proper health care that they need. Tell us about what the governor has done and how that's going to change.
Yeah, so right now, Indiana Medicaid pays lower rates to out-of-state hospitals than they pay to in-state hospitals. It's just a quirk of the system. And generally, these out-of-state hospitals accept the lower rates that Indiana Medicaid pays, even though Indiana Medicaid will pay a much higher rate, especially for children's services, to Riley Hospital for Children in Indianapolis. Representative Slager, and actually, I mean, a whole bunch of Northwest Indiana legislators going back a number of years, including when Slager was out of the Indiana House, have pushed for this legislation to increase what Indiana pays to these out-of-state children's hospitals because they see it as an issue of fairness. There's, you know, sick kids in Northwest Indiana who can be seen in Chicago, 40 miles away, or just on the South Shore, easy drive downtown. Compared to having to drive all the way to Indianapolis and, you know, maybe find childcare for their other children and, you know, make this trip a lot of times, especially, you know, a kid with cancer or other, you know, chronic illness where they're in the hospital a lot. So this legislation is aimed at ensuring Northwest Indiana kids served by Medicaid always have access, particularly to Chicago Children's Hospitals, so they're not, you know, being forced to drive all the way down to Indianapolis every time they need a treatment.
When Hal Slager had brought this up originally, I guess, and in fact, we've had some documentation and having stories and like here on Lakeshore Public Radio about this particular topic. What has he, I guess, been told the most, if you know, that apparently people, parents and kids alike, I guess, have been most concerned about to be able to get these healthcare issues resolved? It's been a long problem, I guess, longer than just maybe probably certainly longer than he's been in office as a legislator.
Right, and there was some concern about the cost. I mean, basically, this is taking Indiana tax dollars and sending it to out-of-state hospitals when most of the time they'll accept the out-of-state hospitals will simply accept the lower rates paid by Indiana Medicaid. But there has been this sort of lingering concern of what if they stop?
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is the idea with this new law that was just signed by the governor is, you know, by increasing the rates, Indiana can make sure that its children will always be seen at whatever hospital is most convenient to them rather than, you know, having to go to Riley. And, you know, I mean, there is this cost factor that we're sending this money out of state, but if the kids are going to Riley, then we're paying more for them to go to Riley anyway. So the cost pretty much works out in the end. And, you know, right now with the American Rescue Plan money and other cost savings that were implemented during the pandemic, Indiana is flush with cash. So, I mean, $1 million for 2 years sounds like a lot of money, but when you're looking at a $38 billion budget, that's really like, you know, a dollar or two.
Yes, not very much. And I understand, too, that Slager's bill also, which is now law, I should mention, does also include some checks and balances by the state. They're going to make sure that all of these reimbursements don't pose a big burden on Hoosier taxpayers. There are some provisions in the measure that are going to, I guess, make sure that everything gets done properly.
That's right. Yeah, it's a two-year program. Normally, when you pass a law, it's good forever. This one, they decided to limit to 2 years to really get a handle on the costs. One of the sort of interesting ways this developed was it started out as only a Northwest Indiana bill at first, and the money was only going to go to Chicago Children's Hospitals that treat Indiana kids. And then some legislators elsewhere in the state were like, wait, you know, the closest hospital for kids in my area is in Louisville, Kentucky, or Cincinnati, Ohio. So they've made this a statewide program. So they thought they had a good handle on the cost when it was just going to be Chicago. So there is a little concern of how much money this is going to cost. The interesting thing about it is Medicaid is mostly paid by federal dollars. So it's mostly federal money that's at stake here. The state itself is probably only looking at, like I said, $1 million or so. So, but Indiana is a fiscally conservative state run by fiscally conservative legislators. So they are going to do a 2-year look back on this and then decide in 2023 whether to keep this program going.
One of your other stories that you had in print and online also covers the General Assembly, the action that lawmakers took over the governor on one of the measures that he had vetoed. And now it's going to, as we all probably suspected, end up in courts. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is an interesting case where the governor is actually suing the General Assembly over a law that was enacted over his veto. This law would allow the General Assembly to convene itself during a statewide emergency. Usually, only the governor can call special sessions of the General Assembly. The General Assembly believes that in a statewide emergency, there is no need to wait for the governor's approval or consent to gather at the State House and pass new laws to respond to the emergency. So they passed this measure that would, in theory, allow them to convene regardless of whether the governor wants them to convene. The governor vetoed the measure. General Assembly overrode the veto and enacted the law, notwithstanding the governor's objections. And now the governor is suing, and he says it's needed. He needs to sue to protect his power. He believes the Constitution, the Indiana Constitution, only gives him the power to call special sessions. And if the legislature can do it whenever they want, then that changes the balance of power in the state, and it's not what the governor claims was envisioned by the Constitution.
Now, I wonder, in this particular case, who is going to be the attorney who shows up in court and represents the governor? Because we know that typically in matters involving the state that the attorney general would step in and take that role, but I understand the attorney general is not in favor of going to court over this.
Yeah, this is actually a sort of an interesting procedural quirk that could end up killing the case altogether. As you said, when an Indiana law is challenged in court, it usually is the attorney general defending the law. And when a state agency needs to go to court, it's usually the attorney general who represents them. The attorney general can give his consent for outside counsel. And I guess the governor's office requested outside counsel in this case. The attorney general turned it down, and the governor's office went ahead and did it anyway. Their argument is that this touches directly at the power of the governor, and the governor doesn't have to, rely on another office holder to protect his authority under the Constitution. Todd Rokita, the attorney general, originally from Munster, sees it another way. He says, basically, he should be the one deciding this case, that the governor and the General Assembly should go make their cases to him, and he should decide who is right and keep the whole thing out of court. I don't know that anybody on either side really wants Todd Rokita deciding this, but Todd Rokita certainly thinks he deserves to be deciding it. Mm-hmm.
One of the other stories that you have out there in print and online is involving another lawsuit. In this case, it's one that has been filed by a number of people who are involved, and some of them from Northwest Indiana, in matters that will bring the Indiana Gaming Commission before a court. Tell us more about this lawsuit that the investors have filed against the Gaming Commission.
Yeah, this is an interesting case. There's very few private casino companies. One of them is a company called Spectacle Entertainment, which is owns the new Hard Rock Casino in Gary, Hard Rock International. That's a separate company, is partially owns the casino and will be operating the casino, but Spectacle actually owns the majority of the casino. And within Spectacle, there's a lot of different shareholders that are somewhat known to the public. They include the Dan Dumasich, who's a former state representative from Schererville, former treasurer of the Indiana Republican Party, sort of well-known big-time Republican fundraiser here in Northwest Indiana. And the Indiana Gaming Commission wants to make sure that these shareholders in private casino companies are sort of held to the same standards as major players in publicly traded casino companies. There's a lot of, I guess, potential for wrongdoing because a lot of what happens at a private casino company is private. It's hidden. It's not publicly disclosed like a Caesars Entertainment or any other company that trades on the stock market. And this all goes back to the former CEO of Spectacle Entertainment, Rod Radcliffe, who recently was, in effect, banned from the Indiana gaming industry after the Gaming Commission began an investigation into various financial and hiring issues that he was involved in. Also, he's also alleged to have organized a straw donor campaign finance scheme for an Indiana congressional race. So the Gaming Commission is saying, we want to know more about the finances and the backgrounds of all these people who are invested in this private casino company. And the people who are being requested to provide this information object to that. They're saying, you know, you don't need 20 years of my business records. You don't need all my tax records. You don't need my college transcripts. So they have sued the Gaming Commission trying to stop this, these emergency rules from going into effect.
It'll be interesting to see how that happens to turn out in the courts when it does show up here. I'm sure that they'll probably, as you probably agree, have some kind of compromise that'll come down sooner or later so that there won't be any ugly details that'll show up in open court about this eventually.
Yeah, you know, one of the great and horrible things about private companies is a lot of their dirty laundry can stay behind closed doors.
Okay. And one final story, and in fact, you have an update, as a matter of fact, on the Times of Northwest Indiana website about it, is this very interesting story that started out just talking about an obscene flag that some Hammond resident has decided to fly along with all the others in his front yard. But now it's gotten the Hammond's mayor involved in all of this. Will you bring us up to date, first off, about what the flag flap literally is all about? And I should mention too, there's a great photo that's in the story online and in print on the Times, and I think Mother Nature must have helped you out on this a bit, because it's not one of these where you have to do any photoshopping. It's been done, I guess, by nature. I understand this, it's done the photoshopping for you. But the idea is that it's an interesting flag, and now a very interesting dispute's going to come out of it. Tell us about that.
Yes, it's this flag features a four-letter word relating to President Biden and the people who voted for him. And it's flying across the street from Riverside Park in Hammond. Mayor McDermott says the specific word used on the flag runs afoul of Hammond's obscenity ordinance, and especially this flag because it is across the street from a park where children are playing. The mayor was especially concerned about youth baseball tournament that was going on across the street over the weekend, and the flag was just flying out there in center field. So the mayor has said that he wants the flag removed, and he plans to send the code enforcement officers to cite this homeowner. Homeowner says he's just expressing his free speech, and he has the right to do so. That was kind of going to be the end of it, but now there's some Southern Indiana conservatives who want to express their opinion on the matter and are planning to drive apparently from Evansville to Hammond on Saturday to protest in front of City Hall and in front of Mayor McDermott's house. And they're encouraging their supporters to bring Donald Trump flags to, I guess, you know, send a message to the mayor that they still support Donald Trump and that they support the message of this allegedly obscene anti-Biden flag.
Now, is the mayor said what he's going to do to, to at least to welcome, if not accommodate, these young conservatives of Southern Indiana who are going to make this a very long trek by car all the way up the state?
Yeah, he's kind of got two ways about it. There's said if they're coming to cause trouble, then that's probably a bad idea, since he is a mayor with a city police force and his wife is a county judge. So yeah. there's a lot of potential problems there if you're looking to stir up trouble. But he says they just want to come up and express their opinion. He said he'll make them coffee because it's a long drive back to Evansville, and he'll be happy to see them get out of town as soon as possible.
Well, we'll see if they, number one, if they do show up, and in what what type of force they're going to show up in, if it's going to be just a few or if it's going to be a multitude of people on Saturday for this event. And we'll have to see how the Hammond police and the other authorities that will probably keep an eye on things are going to deal with it too. And as always, Dan, we thank you for spending time with us to talk about your stories in print and online out there, and bringing us up to date on especially this last one here about the obscene flag and how the city of Hammond is going to deal with that issue that's going to come out of that too. Thanks very much for being with us today.
You got it.
We continue with Reporters Roundtable Thursday when talk with Carol Carlson, who's a freelance reporter for the Post Tribune of Northwest Indiana. And as always, Carol, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, one of your stories that you had out there talks about one of the winners from the 2011 Oscars, 2021 Oscars. And in particular, there is a native of Gary who has picked up a big Oscar and some big acclaim about that. Will you bring us up to date, please?
Yeah, Horace Mann graduate Mia Neal picked up the Oscar for a movie called Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and she headed the hairstyling and makeup department on that movie.
Oh, interesting. What in your story, you covered a lot, of course, about the fact that she is a graduate from the Gary area from school, but also that she's in paid tribute to her late grandfather when she accepted her award the other night.
Yeah, she delivered a stunning speech, I thought, that paid tribute to James Holland, who is Gary's, probably best known in Gary as its former deputy mayor under Richard Hatcher. But she credited him with really being the person behind her and guiding her and inspiring her to go on in her career. He was a Tuskegee Airman, and he was a track and field athlete from Rock Island, Illinois. He participated in the Pan Am Games and attended Northwestern University. And she pointed out that when he went to Northwestern, he was not allowed to live on campus. Simply because he was black, he had to find accommodations at the YWCA in Evanston at that time. He could not, he had difficulty getting a job just because of his race. And that's how he ended up coming to Gary. He got a job at Gary Roosevelt, which at that time was a segregated high school. And it was the only school that blacks in Gary could go to.
I understand that Ms. Neal not only is a graduate from school in the region from Horace Mann High School, she went on to other schools as well too, and that's how she's picked up a lot of her skills that in turn have helped her win the Oscar for hair and makeup. Can you tell us a little bit about more what you discovered in talking with her and in putting together the story?
Yeah, in talking with Mia and her mother, she initially fell in love with hairstyling. Even as a young girl, her mom said she walked in one day and Mia was dyeing her doll's hair with Kool-Aid to get the different effects that she was after. She decided she'd maybe beauty college and being a hairstylist would be her future. And she started out at Merrillville Beauty College and didn't quite feel that suited her. She went on to Columbia College in Chicago and decided that she really yearned to have the on-campus experience. So she went down to a school at a historically black college down in Memphis and finished her education there. And it just by random coincidence, she got a job in a store and selling makeup products. And one of her coworkers told her that because of her interest in hairstyling and makeup, she should look into the program at Juilliard in New York. It's a wig program. And she applied and was accepted. And as her mom said, she never looked back after that.
That's great. That's great. I also understand, too, that in respect to this particular story that you had out there in print and online, that you got a shout-out from one of your colleagues, Phil Potempa. Will you tell us a little about that?
Phil wrote a story today about a young woman from Munster who also was at the Oscars on Sunday, And that woman was in a Oscar short film that also won an Academy Award.
That's great to hear. It shows that, you know, you'd never know who from Northwest Indiana is going to finish high school and maybe later college and get into a career and will end up being famous one way or the other. Like in this case here, I guess you have to say they're not exactly well-known Oscars, but people who watch the Oscar ceremony certainly want to find out more about the other winners besides just the best director and best film and best actors that happen to come up. They want to know about all the people in the crew that have done their part to make the film a success, and in turn, they've made themselves a success as well.
That woman's name is Zaria Simone Thug, and she graduated from Munster High School, and the movie that she was in was called Two Distant Strangers, and it did win for Best Live Action Short Film.
That's great to hear. Well, congratulations to her, and congratulations to both, not only to Nia, but also to her for winning the Oscars that they have picked up during this year as well. And congratulations to all of them. Did they have a kind of party, which, of course, would have to probably be, if not socially distanced, it'd probably have to be on Zoom this time around, wouldn't it?
Yeah, Mia had her sister, I believe it's her older sister, Nia, and some friends from Gary, who attended the ceremony, and they went to a party at Viola Davis's that Viola Davis hosted after the ceremony. Viola Davis was nominated for the Best Actress Award, but she did not win. I think Frances McDormand won that award.
Yeah, I recall seeing the story from NPR about that. Yes, it's true that she didn't, but just the same, she got nominated. And as always, they hate to say better luck next year, but that might be the case here too. She may another film that'll come out and be up for nomination in next year's Oscars, and she might actually pick up that Best Actress Award then too, to be sure. One of the other stories that you had out there in print and online talks about some work closer to home at dear old Roosevelt, as Tommy Williams likes to call it, because being a graduate of Gary Roosevelt High School, now known, of course, as a Roosevelt Career and Academic Academy, is a project that I guess a lot of people take on just as just something to make a neighborhood look neater. And I guess that was the idea that the Volunteer Legion that came out to help at the high school did on that. Tell us about what they went out as far as the baseball field's concerned at dear old Roosevelt.
Yeah, the Railcats and U.S. Steel have a foundation, and it was formed when the Railcat Stadium was built back in the 90s in Gary, there on Fifth Avenue. And they used some of the proceeds from the foundation to support youth sports in the city. And the newly formed Calumet Area Little League is hoping to play games this season at Roosevelt. There are three fields there. And the volunteers identified one field, which is just south of the high school, to be used by the older kids, intermediate and girls softball, for their games. But the field was in pretty bad shape. There were trees and vines growing in the outfield fence, and there were tons of dirt on the infield that had to be removed. So U.S. Steel brought out heavy machinery equipment, wheel loaders and backhoes, and the Railcats groundskeeper was there, and they removed all the dirt from the field, and they smoothed it out, and they added some lime mixture to the field to really make it look nice, and they replaced all the bleachers that were deteriorating with new wood, and they pulled all the trees and vines out of those outfield fences.
We have to give them a shout out. That's great. That's a real spruce job that they did there. And I'm sure the neighborhood probably enjoys that as well. And maybe that will encourage more folks from the neighborhood around Theodore Roosevelt to come over and watch the Little League games.
I think it will. It's a very nice sight right now, and hopefully it'll draw in more kids to play Little League and softball.
What's wonderful to hear. Well, and I hope we should say thank you to the Railcats and certainly to the U.S. Steel Foundation for helping out on this, because that's a major project that would cost a lot of money for somebody to try to have to do on a private basis, but they managed to volunteer and saved the Gary Community School Corporation a lot of money and made it nice for the neighborhood and for the kids who will play on Little League teams this year, to be sure. So, Carol Carlson is a reporter for the Post Tribune. She's covered some stories of note here, not only from Hollywood, but also from the city of Gary. And we thank you for spending time with us to talk about them today.
Thank you, Chris.
And talk to you again soon.
Okay.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. The financial impact of the pandemic has created an environment that is just ripe for scammers. And so the Federal Trade Commission and the National Association of Attorneys General have some new information to help be able to spot and avoid the scams that are happening all across the country. And with us to talk about it, we have Karen Hobbs, who knows both agencies intimately. She's currently the Assistant Director in the Division of Consumer and Business Education at the Federal Trade Commission. And she's also a former prosecutor with the Office of the Cook County, Illinois State's Attorneys, based out of Chicago. And she is with us to talk about this very important issue of avoiding to be scammed. And thank you for joining us on the program today.
Hello.
If you will, first, will you tell us how scams seem to have changed since the COVID-19 pandemic began?
Sure. I mean, there's a short answer and there's a long answer. The short answer is that COVID-related scams are really targeting anyone who's concerned about the pandemic, which basically means everyone. The effect of the pandemic on people is reflected in the consumer reports we get. We've heard from hundreds of thousands of people telling us about their experiences with scams, frauds, and bad business practices that are related to the pandemic. And COVID-19 is really just the latest hook that scammers are using to get you to part with your money or your personal financial information. For example, the numbers of reports we're seeing are growing every day. Since January 1st of 2020, the FTC has gotten nearly 460,000 COVID-related complaints. These reports, the top reports that we're seeing, are related to online shopping issues. So fake websites, non-delivery of goods or services, knockoff merchandise, especially protective gear like masks and disinfectants. Mm-hmm. There are vacation and travel reports. Those are another top getter, which are problems with refunds and cancellations of travel plans. And finally, we're also seeing government imposter scams, which often begin with a call, a text message, or an email. Frequently, they claim to be maybe a court official or a government agency like the IRS or Medicare. And they sometimes will ask you to wire money or put money on a gift card to pay for something. And it's always a very urgent request, knowing that these types of payments can be really hard to reverse.
Do we know what types of people that the scammers are trying to target, or are they basically just, I guess you could call them equal opportunity scammers? They'll scam anybody.
Yeah, it's a fair question, and we get this question a lot. But your instinct is right, that it really is affecting everyone. The pandemic has affected us all, and scammers are willing to scam just about anyone and use any hook to do it.
What are some of the signs that a scammer is at work and maybe trying to get your money one way or the other?
Well, you know, there are some scam-specific signs, but, for example, in vaccine scams, they will tell you to pay them money for access to a COVID vaccine or to get you onto the list. We know that's false. I mean, all vaccines are free. That's a very specific sign of a scam. But other signs are more universal. So anyone who rushes you to make a really quick decision, you shouldn't be rushed into a decision, and you should always try to slow down. When someone tells you to keep something a secret, you should definitely not take their advice. You should always talk something over first with someone that you trust. And, of course, if they start requesting certain types of payments, for example, wire transfers through MoneyGram or Western Union, or they start instructing you to put money on gift cards like iTunes or Google Play cards and then give them those codes, that's a sure sign of a scam. You should never send money to anyone you don't know or haven't met in person, and you should definitely not pay by these methods, which are being used because they're virtually untraceable and they're very difficult to reverse for people. Of course, if they call out of the blue and they say they're with a government agency, that's a sure sign of a scam. The government will not call you, text you, email you out of the blue and ask you for your Social Security number, your bank account, your credit card, and anyone who does is a scammer. We have information on our website about not only coronavirus scams and tips to avoid them, but all sorts of scams. And if people want to learn more about how to spot and avoid scams, they should go to our website, which is ftc.gov/coronavirus.
Well, some great advice, certainly, as you say, not only for any specific scams that are aimed at people because of the COVID-19 pandemic, but scams in general. And Karen, thank you very much for spending time with us. And once again, give that website address so people can find out more. And if they have troubles, they can turn to?
Sure. It's ftc.gov/coronavirus. And if you're looking to stay up to date on the latest scams, we'd ask you to subscribe to our blogs and our consumer alerts. And you can do that at ftc.gov/consumer alerts.
Karen Hobbs is an assistant director in the Division of Consumer and Business Education for the Federal Trade Commission. And thank you for being with us today, Karen.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking and for today and for this week. Our thanks to the Times of Northwest Indiana chief political reporter Dan Carton for the stories he's put out in print and online, and to Post Tribune freelance reporter Carol Carlson for her stories online and in print as well, and to Karen Hobbs from the Federal Trade Commission for her comments and look at scams and frauds, and to our partners at Inside Indiana Business for the feature today. I'm Chris Nolte. We'll be back with you on Monday.